Welcome back to all of you to another live session at WideMoat Investing Summit 2019. It's a real pleasure to introduce our next instructor based in Boston. Gary Mishuris, CFA, is the managing partner and chief investment officer of Silver Ring Value Partners, an investment firm with a concentrated long-term intrinsic value strategy. Gary also teaches the Value Investing Seminar at the F.W. Olin Graduate School of Business. Prior to founding the firm in 2016, Gary was a managing director at Manulife Asset Management since 2011, where he was the lead portfolio manager of the U.S.-focused value strategy. From 2004 through 2010, he was a vice president at Evergreen Investments, later part of Wells Capital Management, where he started as an equity analyst and assumed roles with increasing responsibility, including serving as the co-PM of the large cap value strategy between 2007 and 2010. He began his career in 2011 at Fidelity as an equity research associate. Gary received a SB degree in computer science and an SB in economics from MIT. As many of you will know and appreciate, Gary has shared his wisdom and insights with our members in the past, and we are grateful he has chosen this opportunity to be with us again. So on behalf of the MOI Global membership community, a very warm welcome to you, Gary. Please go ahead.
John, thank you very much for having me, and thank you all for listening. I guess I would just want to compliment you on the amazing work you have been doing as far as building the community, and I really enjoyed meeting you and other members in person at the Idea Week event in Switzerland, which was just terrific. So thank you for that, and thank you for all your work. So I think today I'm not known for brevity, but I think I'm gonna accomplish my task this time. So I'm gonna skip talking about myself because I think John did an amazing job. Having done this for almost two decades, I'm not that interesting. And so, Silver Ring Value Partners to me is really about alignment, passion, and competence. I'm pretty sure I have alignment and passion, and I'll let you be the judge of the competence. I'll skip all of this stuff because you guys can take a look at this on your own. I'm going to get to the main event, which is, what I want to talk about today is a mental model and then a specific investment idea that's based on that mental model. So the mental model I want to talk about is, I think it's common for investors when they look at the stock and it goes up. And Peter Lynch used to talk about when I started Fidelity in 2001, Peter Lynch was already semi-retired, but he was still a mentor there. He would, talk about how he would look at a stock, and that stock, maybe he thought was worth 20, and it was trading at 10, and he wanted maybe to do a little bit more work or something like that, and the stock would go on to 12, and he would say, "Man, I missed it. That's it. The easy money has been made. I'm gonna wait for it to come down back to 10, or something along those lines." And then the stock would, of course, go up to 20, and he would kick himself for not acting on his insight and his work. So I think this is very common. So I think when we look at something and then it goes up a lot, or worse yet, when we sell something and then it goes up a lot, behaviorally, we just don't want to buy it. It's too late, or the money, easy money has been made. And I think sometimes that can be true, but I think the key is, has there been a positive change to the business or new evidence that your original thesis is tracking at or better than expectations? And if that's the case, I think that it's actually the inverse that can be true, which is that the hard money has been made. And now that some of these issues have been resolved, this might actually be a great investment opportunity, an even better one than might have been at a lower price. And that's very hard for us. So I'm gonna talk today about Discovery Communications. And Discovery Communications is a company that I presented in January of 2018. It was a stock that I made a fairly sizable 10% position in November of 2017, so almost 2 years ago. And it was basically at that time quite controversial. And I know a few value investors who I highly respect who sold it back then. And so I think that now it's an even more compelling investment than it was back then, for reasons that I'm going to describe in a minute. But basically, just to review, I structure it as a hedge position, which is unusual for me. I don't hedge most of the time. Most of the time, I just focus on underwriting investment and managing risk at the portfolio level by thinking about position size and how much I can lose in terms of permanent capital loss. But in this case, there were specific reasons why it made sense to hedge. And by the way, for those of you who have access to the presentation, I included the original presentation in the appendix. So I'm not going to rehash everything here, but it's available to you guys to look at. But basically, it was hedged, and the hedge returns were not that bad, but that's not the point. You know, plenty of stocks go up, so what? The point is, I think it's actually a better investment today. And if you're someone who either never looked at it before or even looked at it and kind of said, it went up, so it's too late, I would encourage you to think about it a little bit differently. So basically, just a quick overview, you know, Discovery Communications is a global cable network operator. It owns a number of nonfiction network, which is important, and has about 20% share of U.S. cable viewership. It has three sources of competitive advantage: its brands, its library of content, and its global distribution. And it has revenues that come from both advertising, which is cyclical, and affiliate fees, which is not cyclical, and has long-term contracts associated with them. And finally, you know, key part of the thesis is that there's inelastic demand, and that inelastic demand results in pricing power on both sides of the business. And I think that's really what people don't fully appreciate, and that's why there is this variant perception that I would say I have about the business versus what the market is discounting in the stock price. So just very quickly, this is the breakdown of the revenues on a trailing 12-month basis. You can see that over half of the business is U.S. and about half of the business is advertising, give or take, or a little bit more even. So it's about, close to 50-50 between advertising and distribution. You can also see that U.S. is almost 80% of the profits. So there are a few reasons for that, but U.S. is by far the more important business as far as profitability is concerned. So I'm going to focus there, but certainly international business is important as well. So here are the risks that I saw in 2017. The first one is the main business risk, the secular erosion of the core business, and this is why the stock is still mispriced in my view today. Basically, that people are watching less cable TV and that they're quote unquote cutting the cord by canceling their cable subscriptions and by instead going to a Netflix only model or something like that. That's still a risk. We'll talk about how that's tracking. But there were two other risks, and they were the high financial leverage combined with tightening covenants that we had following the Scripps Network International acquisition that they just did, and also the deal integration risk from that acquisition, which, you know, we both know that the base rate probability of large deals is not good, right? So why is it not good? It's not because the cost synergies don't come through, they frequently do. It's because that culture clash happens or the company gets distracted and revenues melt in a way that management doesn't expect. And in this case, that was a risk, but it didn't happen. And we're, I would say 18 months out or more from 2 years out from the deal. So chances are we would have seen the issues by now. So if we look today, I think the only real risk remaining, and it's a serious risk, and we'll talk about that, is that secular erosion risk. And the other two risks are off the table. So, if we go through the financial situation, after the deal closed, the business was close to 5x levered and wasn't that far away from covenants that were tightening. So it was kind of a little bit of a race against time. And some of the people who were negative said, I don't know, what if we have a recession tomorrow? Are these guys going to come, become financially distressed? I did the analysis, which led me to believe that even in a recession, they would have been fine. But I understand that line of thinking. And typically, as Buffett says, the only way for a smart person with a lot of money to go bankrupt is to use leverage, right? So leverage obviously is a dangerous thing. If you fast forward to today, we're 3.8x levered. And I would argue in a quarter or two, we'll be at 3.5x or under, which is what they committed to the rating agencies to maintain the investment grade ratings. So they're fine. The balance sheet is delivered. This is a sustainable level of leverage. But one piece of information is Discovery recently issued 30-year bonds, and currently the spread on them is 240 basis points to what we know is a fairly low rate of treasury rate. So again, I think the balance sheet is perfectly fine at this point. Next, we had the deal integration risk. And I think the management handled this fairly well in the sense that a lot of times this risk is exacerbated when, you know, the acquirer basically puts their own people in charge of everything, and there's simmering resentment in terms of middle management and other people as their patrons among the upper management are pushed aside, and then people leave, and all of a sudden you find out that, the issues that, you might have hoped to avoid, come to fruition in a year or two. So they actually did a good job of balancing the management team with some of the acquired Scripps executives in fairly senior roles. And also there have been no meaningful departures I could tell. There's no evidence that I can find of integration issues. They've exceeded their synergy targets meaningfully. And I would say that there's the odds are good that if there were issues, we would have seen them by now. So the cycle erosion threat, that one remains. But I will show you in a minute, I think that information that we have so far, so in the 5 to 6 quarters or say year and a half since the original thesis, has been positive and thesis confirming, meaning that the stock has been and is priced as if it's a declining business, right? The thesis is there's, this the bundle is gonna break, or because people are watching less cable TV, that their revenues are gonna decline. That hasn't happened. So that's a positive data point. It doesn't mean that the risk is gone, but if you think about Bayesian updating, right, you have your prior and you have your new incremental information, you have to revise the probabilities in a favorable direction. I would say that the evidence that we have supports my pricing power thesis, and I'll talk about that in a minute. So here is the original organic growth in the US. This is information that we had when I did the original presentation. And the blue bars are all US organic growth, orange bars is US advertising growth, and green bars are US distribution growth. So this was what I was looking at when I made the initial investment. And here is the incremental information that we have since then. You can see that we've been growing low single digits across both our advertising and distribution. And I think that is very thesis confirming. And the reason for that is that this is in a phase of mid-single digit declines in their ratings, which is roughly in line with the cable industry. And this is also in the face of low single digit decline in the number of subscribers. So this is pricing. Now you might say this is bad. I actually think this is good because I think most people, at least the market as a whole, is misunderstanding how this business works. And they have their own mental model for thinking, well, if volume is declining, that's bad for the moat, and that means that pricing should, come down. It's actually in this business the other way around because of inelastic demand, because advertisers essentially have to spend the money and distributors have to, have to have this content, which is part of the rationale behind the deal because now they truly have a must-have portfolio. Another piece of evidence I would bring to bear is that since then they got onto all the virtual platforms. So a virtual platform is something like a YouTube TV or a slim bundle from someone like Dish. So basically, they weren't fully distributed on those, and those are the fastest parts of the market in terms of growth. So you had arm's length negotiations between them and very large companies, and that basically sat down and validated the fact that their content is must-have. And they got on those platforms at very good pricing with mid to high digit, single digits price increases, from my understanding. Every year. So again, you have incremental evidence that they're perceived by market participants who are dealing with them as very, must-have and therefore inelastic in terms of the demand. As far as international, here's the picture we saw when I made the investment originally, and this is the incremental information. Now, I'll just point out that Q1, the negative bar is mostly driven by the comparison with Olympics in the prior year. So I would say international has been a little disappointing. There's a bunch of reasons for why, versus my original thesis, but I would say that the magnitude has been small, and importantly, it's still growing, and that's in the face of Europe's economy not being particularly great, recession, Brazil, which is an important market for them. So there's definitely some cyclical negatives affecting that as well. So as far as valuation, I was, someone put up, podcast format replays of the Berkshire Hathaway annual meetings from 1994 till now, which is great. So if you guys haven't seen those, I've been re-listening or listening to those, and that's been terrific. And so one of the things that Buffett said that I was listening to the other day was, we don't use complicated valuation models because we want investments that are so obvious as to not need one. So, in that spirit, so here is the simple math. So Discovery earned $3.40 in free cash flow per share last year in 2018. This year should be somewhat higher, puts and takes, but it should be somewhat higher, certainly unlikely to be lower. And at $27, $28 per share, the stock is essentially at 8 times free cash flow. Leverage is at sustainable levels, so we can't make an argument that, well, it's a cheap stock on free cash flow, but it's over-leveraged, so they're going to reduce debt. They don't need to reduce debt much beyond maybe this current quarter. And I expect free cash flow and earnings to grow moderately over the long term. So simplistically, without any formulas, pretty obviously to me, if that view is correct, and that's an if, that the stock is meaningfully undervalued. So here is the less simplistic version, the DCF value range, which is kind of my standard approach, or an intrinsic value range from worst to best with a base case as my most likely scenario. And here we have a range with a worst case of 13, so still very meaningful downside, a base case of 47, which puts the stock at about 60% of its intrinsic value. As a sanity check, the base case implies around 12 times normalized earnings versus the single digits multiples that we're at now. And another sanity check is, if you were to buy the whole business, never change the capital structure, and just receive my base case scenario free cash flow stream, your IRR would be 16%. So again, it's pretty cheap, especially in the market, which I would argue doesn't have a lot of opportunities, certainly not among large companies, but I would argue not many opportunities among any size of companies. I would say that if you believe what I believe, this is a pretty interesting opportunity. So there are still risks. Risks are unavoidable. The bundle can still break, in the US at some point. The cycle of threats can still materialize. You also need to adjust the earnings and free cash flow stream for the fact that we are well past the mid-cycle level in this current cycle. So the half the business or so that's advertising, you would probably need to normalize down. I do that in my model, but so you can say, well, 340 is a little bit above mid-cycle, but it's not drastically so. So it's not doesn't change the picture completely. So those are risks. You also have the risk that the company does go on a large shopping spree and start buying assets instead of shares. The dynamic here, so you have John Malone as the kind of the man pulling the strings, right? And if you listen to some of the recent interviews that John has given, he pretty much made it clear that he doesn't like companies just buying back shares and increasing intrinsic value that way. That's not fun. Now, John Malone has created tremendous value. I'm nobody to criticize him. And I think I understand some of the reasons for his views, but some of the other stuff comes across, to be honest, as like it's more fun to do big, bold, strategic deals and play three-dimensional chess. I mean, look, if you're a billionaire and you're not, very young, let's say it this way, it doesn't matter how many billions you're going to have other than a way of keeping score versus having something that's a little bit more interesting and, gives you intellectual gratification. So I would say there's a little bit of a bias towards action, but so far, all the acquisitions have been, other than scripts, have been small tuck-ins, sports deals, things that are very consistent with the strategy. So I would say that John Malone's track record speaks for itself. I don't think he's going to intentionally do stupid deals or just do large, expensive acquisitions. I think the risk is that of some kind of behavioral bias on his part towards activity and away from just doing the obvious, which is meaningfully reducing share count. And the other risk I would say is that the CEO, David, is very promotional. I honestly have trouble every time he speaks in public. It's only the good news. It's how awesome everything is, and never, very rarely gives relevant metrics to support that, and almost never talks about any problems. That to me is a yellow flag. I would much rather hear someone who's balanced and, talks about the bad news and also what he's doing about it. So it's, I wish we had a CEO who wasn't so keen on marketing to his shareholder base, and instead just communicate with us as if we were minority partners in the business and just tell us like it is. That being said, he's been there for a decade and he's created a lot of value. So I think that while he's no one's perfect, I would say it's something to keep in mind because there might be hidden problems that I don't know about, but it's not something that makes me think he's bad as an operator. So where that puts me is that this is still a large position for the partnership. It now hedged, still hedged with the options, which have increased in terms of the strike price as the price went up to manage risk. And the options expire in 2020. And at this point, I don't think it makes sense to continue to be hedged beyond that, because the reasons to be hedged were to get rid of the discrete risks of the balance sheet and of the integration risks, which are mostly behind us. So if the price to value gap does not close in the next 8 months or so, I'm going to have to rethink about position size and how I want to manage risk going forward. But I would say this is certainly an interesting investment. It certainly means the value of my estimates. And I think that there are just a lot of people who are unwilling to look at it because they are looking at a stock that went up from $15, $16 at the trough to high 20s, and they don't want to get their mind around the secular issues. But if you do the work, I think you're going to be rewarded, if I'm right. Disclaimers say pretty much do your own work and don't sue me. And this is my contact information. I'm going to leave it on the screen in a minute. I attached the original presentation. It's very long. I'm not going to go through it all, but it's there. Hopefully, John will make it available for download. And then with that, John, happy to answer any questions.
Well, Gary, thank you so much for this update on Discovery. To everyone on the line, if you do have a question, feel free to type it in at this time. I'm showing a few questions, so I'll just start with the queue. On slide 15, it shows phenomenal growth in advertising in 2010, 11, and 12. And the question relating to that is what this is attributed to and what has happened since then.
So I would say back then the cable network business was a much higher growth business. So if without getting into the history of all advertising for the last 50 years, the history of all advertising for the last 50, 60 years has been newer media coming in and gradually taking share from older media, but the older media not disappearing, but gradually losing share. You can think of radio, newspapers, and so forth. So one of those shifts has been the shift from broadcast TV to cable TV. And part of that was driven by the fact that cable TV had a much lower share, so they were gaining share. Another part was driven by CPMs, which is an industry term for cost per thousand, significant pricing, being far higher for broadcast than for cable, and that gap partially narrowing. Now, that gap should never narrow completely because there is a premium in media for larger audience. So just to walk people the math, if you have a 10 million audience versus 10, 1 million audiences, the 10 million audience is more valuable because you're more comfortable with it. All else is equal, is there's no duplication. So if you're trying to reach a lot of people, you're always going to put a premium on the largest audience. So that gap would never narrow because cable tends to deliver smaller audiences than broadcast, but nonetheless. So in 10, 11, the secular issues that we're talking about now with Netflix and cord cutting and so forth haven't really started yet. And you're also coming up out of recession. So this advertising is a cyclical business. And you could see that in the last recession, they were doing well enough that they actually didn't decline, which is not something I would expect going forward, by the way. And so 10, 11, and 12 were the economy was recovering and you had a secular tailwind. And the change has been is that in the last 4 or 5 years, now there is a secular headwind where cable advertising is losing share because ratings are declining. And a lot of it is because viewers have more options, Netflix being a major one, but also YouTube being another. So data shows that the amount of time spent on TV has not changed. Actually, it's been increasing gradually over time. But within that pie, the traditional TV ecosystem has had a smaller share of that time over than it had 5, 6 years ago. Does that answer the question, John?
Yeah, I think so. If I can shift gears a little bit to the valuation, it shows a wide range of outcomes. Could you talk about any catalysts that may be associated with the base case or best case scenarios, please?
Yeah, so I'm gonna try and drag my spreadsheet here. Can you see it, John, on the screen?
Yep.
Okay, cool. So when I look at that range again, ignore the false precision. Obviously, the decimal point doesn't matter, and so obviously Buffett is right to be approximately right versus precisely wrong. But so some of the key assumptions, and I look at something like, and I look at my base case, and I'm going to make it bigger so you guys can see. Some of the key assumptions is, what distribution and advertising going to be growing U.S. internationally, and then essentially it's how competitive will the business get. I am building in a down cycle, so you can see that I have a recession here in 2020, not because I think that there will be one, but because there will be one at some point, and this is a cyclical business. So I would say, the range is wide because it's a business where there is a cycle risk. So if you go to my worst case scenario and compare the assumptions, hopefully this is big enough for you guys to see, I actually have this as a declining business with a much bigger recession. So that translates naturally into margins that are, just to show you here, the margins, they're actually falling, right, meaningfully. So I tend to underwrite investments to kind of a two standard deviation range. So this is not an impossible scenario, but I would say it's a very unlikely scenario. But I found that my 18 years in the business since, I started right as the tech boom was ending, you pretty much want to underwrite to a wide range because the last thing you want to do is be shocked and surprised just as the time for action is most pertinent. As far as catalysts, I think, look, you have a business at 12, 13, 14% free cash flow yield. I would say the catalyst is continuing to deliver revenue and free cash flow growth because the price only makes sense if you have a situation where the business is a melting ice cube and it's shrinking. You also have more and more optionality. So if they're delivering 13% of the market cap in free cash flow, they can either retire that much in shares, which is something I would like to see, or they can buy interesting assets. And that's been more things like niche sports rights in Europe to try to create a mold around that business and create even more inelastic demand there, things of that nature. So I would say, if I'm right, time is now aside because the value is growing. They're generating massive free cash flow. The business is actually not shrinking at all. And the longer that the stock remains at these levels, as long as they're on the same trajectory, I would say the more undervalued the shares get. And ultimately, I think even John Malone is going to say, look, enough is enough. I'm going to buy back 20, 30, 40% of the shares over a couple of years. And if you guys don't want it, we'll take it.
So there's a couple of questions related to the moat itself. If you could elaborate on the moat that you see. And one specific question is that although Discovery is historically the leader in unscripted content, can you discuss the ease with which new competitors such as Netflix, Facebook, or Apple or others could do the same?
Yeah, it's a very fair question and one I think about a lot. So there's, I guess, two main sources of competition. One is, from someone trying to purposely program their type of content. And what's their type of content? It's non-fiction, non-sports, non-news, right? So you have Discovery Network, Home and Garden TV, Food, Travel, Animal Planet, and so forth. So Netflix a few quarters ago actually talked about spending some money on non-scripted. That being said, this is far away from their core. And when Discovery used to be a long time ago on the Netflix platform, Netflix did not see a lot of people essentially going and viewing their content, which is part of the reason why they couldn't agree on a renewal price. So interesting enough, the brand that Netflix has built is much more about new releases. It's much more about kind of water cooler conversation, House of Cards or Orange is the New Black, whatever that might be. And it's much more about that kind of buzz generating shows. That being said, I think they are going to have more content. And I think that that is a risk. And I think that's a risk I am building into my assumption that the ratings for Discovery will continue to decline at mid-single digit rates. That being said, I think that it's important to realize that Netflix, so a lot of people when they use, let's say they want to watch something about animals, they're not necessarily looking for a specific show. Sometimes they are, but sometimes they just want to watch stuff that's in their genre that they love, right? And they know that the destination for that's part of the brand advantage. Animal Planet is the TV destination for watching stuff about animals. So, that's different than searching out a specific show that, Netflix might have and looking it up and saying, I want to watch, I don't know, monkeys from this country or from this breed doing XYZ. That's just not how people consume that kind of content, as opposed to, I want to watch this drama and, give me episode 7 because I watched episode 6 last time. So I think it's a little bit different in terms of the kind of content. And that brings me to my second point of, what about user-generated content, YouTube? So yeah, you can watch, cat boxing videos on YouTube or, monkeys running around on YouTube. And you can say, well, isn't that, a substitute essentially for this? Yes and no, because yeah, it's a hit, and you watch it, great. But again, that doesn't replace the need for someone who wants to relax in the evening and watch, I don't know, again, those, show about, the history of the species for an hour after dinner with, enjoying a beverage with, their loved ones or by themselves. It's a different need that they're solving. And it's short form content. So it's not to say that I'm ignoring it or that I don't think it will have an impact, but I think the fact they have brands, which means that they have mind share with customers who know that this is the destination for this type of content, gives them permission to iterate and come up with different content. So I like this model a lot better than, this typical model of, oh, I have a couple of anchor shows that's, amazing, and if those don't succeed or those end, I need equally amazing hits to replace it. This is less about hits, although obviously some hits are important. It's more of the fact that they, have a very strong position and niche, and that gives them, the first call from someone who's a viewer who wants to watch that content.
And can you talk a little bit more about how you think about the economics of providing content on cable versus through a Netflix or Hulu type of platform?
Well, so the economics on the economics on cable is that you basically have to pay a distributor. The economics on some of these, what are called over the top, is that they're essentially free riding to some degree on the infrastructure investment that someone's already made, namely the cable company. So I would say that it's tough to compare because, so if you look at, for instance, well, there's two levels. There's the economics to the distributor, which obviously it's a very different model. If you're Netflix, you're essentially asset. Well, you're not asset light because you're, investing in content, but you're asset light because you don't have to invest in infrastructure. But if you look at the economics, so let me drag this guy over here for a second, direct your attention to the screen. So if you look at the historical data for margins for this company, I'll point you in the right place in a second. Hopefully you can see this. So this is U.S. network margin, EBITDA margins. By the way, there's very little CapEx. So, CapEx is 1% of sales. So EBITDA is the same as EBITDA for this business model. You have 55 to 60% margins. And part of the reason for that is, so you basically, you don't have expensive kind of talent that you're negotiating with, unlike dramas or news anchors. So, not to pick on monkeys, but the monkeys don't get residual rights, for their performance, right? So you own the content, so you're vertically integrated. And that's a key advantage for Discovery as well, because a lot of cable networks, all they do is more or less package other people's or even their own content, but they're buying it from another division, which could have sold it to someone else. These guys own all their content. It's low cost to create in terms of cost per hour. And the beauty of it is it travels well internationally because, unlike something, not everything, but things like food travels to some degree, certainly and Discovery travels, science travels, and animals travel. Some things don't, like home and garden TV probably doesn't travel as well because they're cultural nuances. So you have basically a fairly low cost model because you can amortize that cost of creation with very low incremental costs across a lot of geographies, which is not something you can do with, say, a comedy, because a lot of humor doesn't doesn't travel, to different cultures. So I'd say the cost to create is very low. And back to the question compared to Netflix, I mean, Netflix doesn't necessarily have a cost advantage in terms of creating nonfiction content versus these guys. They do have a cost advantage versus a cable provider like a Comcast in terms of that they're free riding on the latter's infrastructure to some degree. But I don't think they have a cost advantage versus Discovery because in their niche, they have pretty massive scale. And I would say Netflix's global scale overall is bigger, but in nonfiction genres that Discovery plays in, I would say their scale is more than sufficient to have as low a cost as anyone else.
And another question on a slightly different topic here in the queue, whether you have any thoughts on the recent Mediaset delisting and relisting together with other European broadcasters.
That's an easy one. No thoughts, unfortunately. It's not an area that I'm very familiar with. And I don't know if my friend Patrick Brennan is listening, but I would bet that Patrick would be the world's expert on stuff like that. So he would be a much better person to ask.
Terrific. We'll leave it there, Gary. Thank you so much for taking the time to spend with us again and update your thesis on Discovery. Truly appreciate it.
Thank you, and thank you very much, John, for everything you've done. And as I scroll down here, if you guys have any further questions, check out my contact information here. I'm always happy to start a dialogue.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And thanks to all of you for listening. We're going to have our keynote Q&A session with Tom Russo coming up at 2 p.m. Eastern, and I hope you'll join us for that. Goodbye for now.